Hello and welcome to another episode of SolarWinds Tech Pod. My name is Sean Sebring, joined as always by my fellow host, Crystal Taylor. And today we're going to be visiting something we do every year, IT Trends and Predictions, but this year for obviously 2026. Today we're joined by two guests, which we are very happy to have. A regular guest of ours, you see him often, he's all about SolarWinds, our very own Sasha Gisa. And joining us for the first time on TechPod is Lauren Okru. So Lauren, since this is your first time joining us on TechPod, would you give us a quick introduction about your role and kind of what you'll be bringing to the table as far as your experience and thoughts goes?
Yeah, of course. First of all, thanks so much for having me. It's super exciting to be on the infamous TechPod. My name is Lauren, as Sean said. I've been at SolarWinds for over a year and a half, not quite 2 years. I work in product marketing. So, you know, I hope today to bring a perspective, not just about the technology, but maybe about perception and, you know, how everything kind of matters along the fronts of the trends as well. So at SolarWinds, I tend to focus on our ITSM products and newly acquired incident response products. So I think we'll have a lot of great things to talk about. Definitely talk about the tech trends, but also maybe the broader picture of what that tech means for businesses, you know, across the globe.
Absolutely. No, great stuff. And selfishly, super happy to have another ITSM advocate on the call. I'm usually tooting my horn by myself over here, even though these guys will unwaveringly support all of my... Anyway, so we're here to talk again about trends and predictions. Again, something we do every year at the start of the year. A not surprising theme will show up in here. Our friend Al. I mean, AI. Oh, yes. AI. It was just visually on the paper. That's what it looked like as Al. Forgive me. So AI, we're not surprised that's going to be showing up. But there's something that's a little bit different this year as opposed to last year. It's not that it wasn't here, but it's definitely hitting hard in the trends piece, right? You almost can't not hear it. And that is the shift to agentic. And so agentic is taking on kind of, it's almost like when ChatGPT first hit, right? It was kind of this huge roller coaster of, oh my gosh, it's revolutionizing everything. And now agentic itself is kind of changing what we thought of as AI, at least as far as how it's leveraged in the business and tech world. So to get us kind of started, because a lot of the trends and talk about agentic is going to revolve around this, I'd like to get us started with maybe Lauren, you can take a whack at it first. What do you think agentic means to the public as far as how it is used in the industry?
Yeah, a great question. I think if we look at the solution that agentic might bring, especially maybe in the world of ITSM, a lot of those, we'll call them paper cut issues. Those things that are really repetitive, they seem really small, but like a paper cut, when you get so many of them, the pain is very real, right? So I think agentic is going to really start to, you know, we were in generative AI or in regular AI, let's call it traditional AI, we were solving level one issues. And I think agentic is going to take us to that level zero or even that LN, like the, you know, it's before it even becomes an issue. And it's going to take all of those paper cuts away. And I think that's really going to, you know, it could really do things like boost team morale. I think people might be a lot happier in their jobs. You know, I think this was a topic last year. It's going to shift what people do for their work. They might not be doing the traditional things they were doing before because now the agentic might solve that. So they're going to shift into maybe more strategic roles, things like that. But yeah, I think, you know, other than resolving those paper cut issues, which I think are really undervalued in their impact, I think it might really transform the way we approach our work, not just the resolutions.
Yeah, I was seeing that in the trends as well. Human jobs aren't going away, they're changing, right? So we're more of a supervisory to AI, auditor, compliance, accepting things, risk included, right? So it's, again, it's very similar, especially from the frontline approach. We want to fix small issues with AI, But Agentic is taking a little bit of a different approach to it than just how we were previously, like you said, with traditional AI. So Sasha, anything you want to add to how you think Agentic would differ from our generative?
Well, many years ago, I left a job because the repetition killed me. I always did the same and the same and the same stuff over. And I think we all go through these phases where you master a job, and when the repetition continues, it gets terribly boring. So I have like high hopes for agentic AI to remove that element. On the other hand, it will still keep us busy because, as you just mentioned, we have to supervise the AI. We have to continue to teach the AI new things, and we have to control it. That's very important. And I guess this will be a challenge at some point when an agentic AI gets so complex that it does do things that we no longer understand. But that is maybe a prediction for next year, not for 2026.
I agree. I think that one of the things that's interesting about agentic is that it really opens the doors for connectivity. So agents are talking to other agents, which really gives us a lot more flexibility in what we can do. So like these tasks that you guys are talking about taking over, the reason why we're going to be able to address those things is because we're now going to have agents that can talk to each other in different platforms and things like that. And that's been really interesting to like think about how we're, like you said, Lauren, like think about how we're doing work, and it's going to change the way that we do work. I do also think, Sasha, that I agree with you that in some ways it does mean that we are probably going to approach a state of not knowing how to do the task anymore, because like there is, I went to Ignite 2 weeks ago and I attended a talk while I was there. It was about vibe coding, but I think it's very important to also think about it in the terms of agentic, of that in order for us to continue to build and manipulate AI, we still need to understand the fundamentals and the basics. And while right now it's very exciting, agentic's exciting, all the things that we're doing with AI is exciting, it's also, there's fear, right? Because like there some of the predictions were about cybersecurity concerns and things like that, because while there's additional connectivity, that increases risk in a lot of ways as well, right? Like now there's other entry points where they can be used. They can use agentic AI to connect to other things. So like there is, if the landscape is changing, as it always is, because this is IT, the landscape is changing, but it is going to be really interesting to see how agentic AI transforms every role, not just tech roles, because it is not going to be just tech roles. I mean, you can see virtual agents in ITSM platforms now on websites. And those are going to continue to expand as they hook into agentic AI. And now you can ask questions about other things. And so like all of these things are going to expand. And that is kind of a little bit terrifying because there isn't enough governance around that. And I don't think that we're going to see enough governance around it come up in 2026. So I'm with Sasha on like maybe following in the next like 5 years, we'll start to see that. But it feels like governance is behind. And so industry, you're going to be responsible for your own governance. And that can be scary in a way as well, because it means that people are more willing maybe to take risks for the bottom dollar than they would if their whatever entity, government entity or compliance that they have to adhere to were to say, no, there's major fines, because as we know, it comes down to the bottom dollar. So I think it's going to be a really interesting year with agentic really taking off, because it's already begun. Like we were already seeing it places, and it's really, I think it's going to explode next year.
To tie a bow on the what is agentic, all great stuff. The big theme that stood out to me in looking at the trends and all the ways it was phrased is it's autonomous versus just automation, right? Which means it's taking action versus making just recommendation. So the fact that it's taking action, I think the word that Sasha used, and I can't remember if I said it as well, was supervising, right? If I have an agent, which agentic is in the word for sure, right? If I have someone on my team, I'm delegating that to them now with a level and degree of trust. And so my job is to, fingers crossed, hope that they're doing the best and accurate things for the most part. And every now and then I'll step in and monitor and audit and supervise the work that they're doing. But yeah, it is a huge risk as well. And the governance that you would need, because we're actually saying, okay, AI, I trust you enough to say I'll supervise what you did, not supervise what you are doing, right? So that level of risk is definitely there, but the power that it holds is crazy. So I think you're right, big time. Over the next few years, it's going to become easy enough to implement, but the gap we'll have is around the governance to make sure what it's doing is ethical and correct and accurate, I suppose would be a good way to put it.
The way you said it there, though, to me, it doesn't sound too different from a traditional org structure, right? Like,
no, not at all.
A supervisor and an employee, there is like a high degree of trust. I think the thing that you really bring to mind for me is like, at what point do the supervising actions take place?
Yeah.
And I think that's an important part of the puzzle.
Absolutely. Like,
how much is autonomous? And where does the human stay in the loop before?
Well, that's where that governance piece will come in is, you know, there will be more policies around review checkpoints and, you know, at what point during development of an agentic role do we say it's ready for a release? What types of UAT are in, right? It's its own new type of app development within a process, right? It's like you're developing apps for processes now as you go instead of apps for apps and what apps do, right? So as confusing as that could be. But no, these are exactly, you know, the kinds of things that I think are what we're trying to predict is what's going to be important next year as this kind of technology is on the horizon. Once it's already here, let's be honest.
I think though, like based on what you were just saying, Lauren, like the place to start is the same place we start with all automation, which is things that are already repeatable actions, right? Like we don't have to just give it the keys to the kingdom right away and say, hey, go solve all of my problems. Like, while that is a pie in the sky dream for our bosses, I'm sure, of like just being able to say, hey, go solve all the problems. You know, we don't have to have any input. We're not there. The technology isn't there. But also, I think that you can have a measure of starting to build trust within your organization if you start at the same level you would already start doing automation now, right? Like things that you're already handing off to an intern or a junior engineer or something like that you're already like, we can hand this off to someone else. We can hand this off to a script. We can hand this off to an automation process. Like that's a great place to start building trust in the org. And then you can start exploring, like, what other things can we do? Because that will build excitement, right? Because all of those tasks take time that you don't want to be spending doing those tedious tasks. As Sasha mentioned earlier, we get stuck in the routine. We get doing these tedious tasks all the time. And then our jobs get boring. We start looking for something else. So I think that it's a good place to start. And I hope that my hope for 2026 is that is where we don't put the cart before the horse, as it were. Like, be a little more conservative with how you're implementing your agentic stuff so that you can build that trust. Because one of the things that I think we've seen with ChatGPT blowing up and all of that stuff over the years with AI is that initially there's huge skepticism, and rightfully so, because it's not quite ready for prime time, but everyone's really excited about it. And so then, you know, like there's all the jokes, right, about like, it can't tell you how many R's are in the word strawberry or like whatever, right? Like there's clear and present flaws that you can find very easily. And then that dismisses your trust that you have. And so then people won't want to use it for the actual task that they need to use it for. So consider that as you're moving into your agentic era, you know, work on building trust, because I think that is important. Not only building trust, but reinforcing that trust that it is trustworthy. Otherwise, it's going to be a real interesting time.
One thing I want to take from my notes that I really hope persists through is a description of what agentic AI means to the humans' roles coming up is stewards of governance. And I'm like, gosh, can I please get that in my title? I want to be a steward. Let's bring titles like this back. I want to be a steward of governance, right? Or a duke. You know, I'd take a duke. That'd be cool too. But no, good stuff. You know, part of transitioning out of just talking about what does agentic AI mean, I stumbled over saying we're you know, creating processes and automating the processes with other processes. And that kind of brings me to something else that showed up in the trends, which is shadow vibe apps, which I hadn't really heard until I started doing research for what does the rest of the world think is going to go on in 2026. But shadow vibe apps is exactly that, is like, I have such access to tools where I can automate my own processes that I'm basically making apps to solve my own problems without going through any of the governance, right? It's so accessible to me. I can just make my own automations. I can create my own potentially agentic solutions to my own problem so that I can have more early glasses of wine because I've taken care of everything I need to in the day. I wanted to spark Sasha's interest and pass this one over to him first.
That was my keyword. I suppose when you work from home, we all are in the situation when the mouse doesn't move often enough, we go into like a hibernation mode. Maybe with the wipe code stuff, I can create a small tool that will move my mouse and IT won't notice. So it's a shadow app, isn't
it? We'll call them dodgy vibe apps now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is a real problem. We tend to use these tools. So we used to do any kind of tool in the past, and IT had to put a lock in front of it for security reasons. And now giving employees such a powerful tool so they can build their own following recipes in the internet, basically, that opens a can of worms that can be very, very dangerous, particularly when those are used by people who have no idea of IT. So they don't really know what is the impact of a possible outcome. And that is far worse than having a glass of wine too much, I suppose.
I think the shadow vibe apps are really just the next evolution of shadow IT. So what we should see in the next year or so is software coming out that detects these shadow vibe apps, right? Like when you're doing monitoring and things now, you can run discovery scans to find, IT things, you know, switches, whatever, machines that are coming in. BYOD has always been, it's been a problem for a long time, right? Like you can find virtual machines that have been left behind. You can find all kinds of stuff right now with the stuff that we're doing. But the next level of that is going to be searching out those shadow apps, right? Like, because that's where we need to be going. We need to be solving that problem, because Flush is right. This is going to become a real problem, not just for individuals, but for the companies, because they're going to have stuff running that they don't know about. And then we already have situations where people are spinning up things in the cloud, and then that has unexpected costs. And like, this is just going to escalate all of that. It's going to get way worse.
So what we need is an agentic process to identify other unauthorized agentic processes. Okay, so Lauren, do you have any thoughts on this before we change topics a little bit?
I do, and I'll just preface this with I'm an eternal optimist, right? I'm a glass always half full kind of girl. So while I think there's huge risk, and everyone has pointed that out, isn't it an amazing time of innovation? I feel like if organizations don't just dismiss these shadow vibe apps, these shadow IT items, if they actually, you know, govern them, say, you can't use this, but explain to me what you were doing. Like, let's talk about what you were building and see, can we replicate it in a way that's compliant with what we're working in? I think this is a really exciting time. Like, people have so much more ability to and freedom to kind of solve their own problems. Like, isn't it Steve Jobs that said, like, I'll hire lazy people all day long because they find the shortest route to the solution. Like, while shadow IT has, you know, a lot of risk and it's very serious and I don't condone it at all, I do think, you know, the level of innovation that's available right now is really exciting. And I think if people just harness that, by people, I mean organizations, you know, if they discover these things, you know, like, get across the severity of it, but also take the time to say, now show me what you were doing and let's see if we can, you know, make it something that works across the org. I think it's you know, something to be concerned about, but also a really nice area of opportunity for innovation.
Oh, I completely agree. I think that this is a huge time for innovation, but I also think it's the shadow part that we have an issue with. So really what would be optimal is if businesses provided a sandbox that people could go play around in that wasn't going to jeopardize everything else if something got smart.
That is the answer, Crystal.
So I couldn't agree more. And this is a great segue into what I think would be a great next topic. And we'll focus on IT's perspective, but know that it could be applicable to any part of the business anywhere. It's just, I see it starting in IT again, because IT's just more comfortable and familiar with playing with technology. And that's that, let's start with, IT isn't just a cost center anymore. And so one of the reasons and things I that kind of comes to mind, and this goes to exactly what both of you were saying, is what if the metrics for me are now changing as an IT person? It's not about the number of tickets I close. Maybe it is, but that's not the biggest one. What if it's making sure that the tickets closed are in good shape? But then another key metric that my management's now looking for is number of innovations that I did, right? How many processes did I automate? And with that, it comes with, again, the kind of governance aspect that we brought up earlier of what's our process for approaching the creation of an automation and saying, here, I want to automate this. Do I have a safe place to test it out? Right? Can I build it and then hand it over to a different team that's responsible for vetting my automation? But again, encouraging companies to, more than they already do, encourage the innovation. Because I've been at several companies who have said, oh, you know, we've got innovation prizes, we'll have campaigns, or we say, you know, pitch your innovation idea. But if we really truly are much more capable of leveraging the agentic AI to do a lot more work, I'm now free to be more innovative. I'm more free to now say, okay, I need to focus on optimization. Then it should be much more focused on and given the space to the employee to do that. And I think of Google when I think of that, because there's a percentage of time that Google intends to give, at least in the past, this is how it was, to focus on this kind of innovation. Something that's not dedicated to your normal specific role of just working on tickets. And so I think, again, I don't know that that'll happen in 26. I would love it. But I think it's something that we should start considering or developing the governance around in saying, you know, when I look at this role, right, and this is for recruiters out there maybe, and managers, is when I'm looking at my role, do I want to create space in my job description for this? And do I want to set it as expectations for something that I want to see from an employee rather than just their current, what the current job description looks like today? Crystal, maybe you should go first. I see the teeth gritting and yeah.
Okay. One of the times that I'm in disagreement with you, Sean, I think that we are going to see new metrics, yes, but I do think that harnessing a metric around innovation, a KPI, a requirement for non-creative roles, even for creative roles, is extremely challenging to create metrics around creativity, and also can be extremely damaging to people who are not interested in doing that. There is a large subset of people that work in tech roles that just want to head down, do their task, finish all their tasks for the day and leave for the day. And injecting that requirement could be damaging to your, not only to your employee morale, but also it could be damaging to just the employees themselves. They may start looking elsewhere because they don't want those requirements. We're like, you look like you're ready to do a battle. We're about to have like a rap battle here.
Oh, this is a great juicy debate for what we can predict though, because roles should be evolving too. And so
yes,
feeling like we want to stay locked into accepting, you can stay doing that same old role. We don't need to evolve the role, right? I think that's the dangerous part where all these predictions and trends say, if you don't evolve, you're going to get left behind. So maybe the roles have to evolve.
I think they're two different things though.
Okay, fair.
I think that the roles do have to evolve. Their responsibilities do have to evolve, but requiring creativity is different than requiring them to use a new technology, right? Like you have to go learn a new technology and learn how to use that and learn how to, even learning how to automate, right? Like you could say, you could argue that that's creativity, but as soon as you put a KPI around that, a lot of people will immediately balk. Like, oh, I don't know how to, I get overwhelmed with too much when someone tries to tell me, you can go do anything you want. It's why I can't play Minecraft. You can do anything you want in this space. I need you to do 10 cool things in this space. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do something really boring because I'm completely overwhelmed. And I'm just going to make a thing I know I can make that's already been made before. So I think that the challenge here is that some roles could probably benefit from something like that. But how can you require it? Like if you have 5 people in one role and 2 of them are innovators, it's still extremely great for your company. It's extremely great for your role. The other 3 people might benefit from those innovations, but being the person that creates those innovations might not be in their wheelhouse. And I don't know how you can make it a requirement. Is making it's creativity totally as a requirement is difficult.
We're predicting, we're not aligning. Okay. We're That's both true. Just predicting individually, which is a great, you know, let's pass it over to our guests. Lauren, what are your thoughts?
I think, you know, you guys both make great points. And I think the point you're both making is that the job landscape after AI and agentic is like Minecraft. It's going to be constructed in a way that I'm not sure that we can, the 4 of us can sit here and say, this is how it's going to go. Right. So, yeah. You know, I think what will happen, as it always does when there's new technology, people will show different skills. Those skills will be valuable to an organization. A job will be created in which a job market will evolve. And probably it's going to be, you know, a group of people who are innovators and creative and a group of people who are really good process-oriented doers. And that's, I think you're both making that point, which is the funny thing is that that's kind of how I see it, is that, you know, it's going to evolve. And I think we're seeing that what's going to be required with agentic is going to bring forward maybe really unique roles in tech that haven't existed before, especially in IT. Like there's going to be some things people might, you know, show skills that they didn't show in the past because the application is quite different, or people might move into the IT space that have lived in other types of roles that aren't as, you know, I'm not going to say necessary, but that have been automated. But maybe now, you know, some creative people might move into tech. It's hard to say, but I think everyone has proved the point that it's quite wide open.
You know, it's funny you say that. My previous organization, I did have a role created for me, and just bear with and use your imagination. My title was up in the air. My VP actually asked me to write my own job description, and my title didn't exist yet. What we almost landed on until we realized the implications was process improvement managing professional. And so that was almost the title I went with, but we ended up just sticking with process improvement manager. It was exactly that kind of role, though. I was basically a reconnaissance guy who just went out into any part of the business, right? And we were a smaller insurance company and just said, show me how you're doing your processes today. Let's see if we can automate them more. And it's with the tool that I'm now helping support sell, which is the SolarWinds Service Desk. But just a funny little piece of history there that, yes, creating the role was definitely something I actually went through, and it almost had a really interesting title. But Sasha, what are your thoughts on how this kind of transforms the role landscape of ITSM or IT, isn't just a cost center anymore, right? How, you know, we've been kind of saying things like this for a while, but what's your take on how it's going to change things?
I think we always need to evolve a little bit, and there's probably a phase for every one of us when we start in a job. We are impressed by the way things work, and we try to align ourselves with the processes. But after a while, I guess we look for shortcuts. We look for ways how we can improve our own job, and ideally, those improvements have a bigger impact on the organization. And we might call this innovation now, which is a fancy word, but the process itself is nothing new. Companies do this for decades. They just call it like optimization of processes, efficiency, cost reduction, right? And that is kind of an innovation too. If I change a process in a way and save my company so and so many first world currencies, that is a great benefit. And that will obviously have an impact again on me because it will get me a raise or whatever it is. I think what Crystal mentioned is that some of us are just happy to do the job the way it is. Let me throw a third persona in the room. So the innovator, the person who keeps the head down, and the sine wave, the human sine wave. There's probably a time where we just want to go with the flow. And there's a time where like, hey, yes, I have this idea. I just do this now. And I think we all find ourselves somewhere there. And as long as we do something useful, at least for us, we do something useful for the company we work for.
I love our little debates, guys. This was great. It's a great way to actually individually have some predictions, and I'm mostly talking to Crystal. We don't battle as often as we could in our podcasts here. But Sasha, since you were the last one talking, I think the next topic I want to go back to you is something that we've had dedicated episodes on. And I just want to see what your thoughts are for 2026, because the energy implications of all this AI is just starting to get even more real. I think it was only kind of visible to IT for a little while, and now like governments are much more heavily involved in, uh-oh, what's going on, right? And infrastructure concerns and the heat, all sorts of different things. So Sasha, I just kind of want to get your take on, you know, it's been another year. And quickly, as part of just this episode, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, new tech, more requirements, more data centers, more energy consumption, bad for the environment, yada, yada, yada. That's something that happened in the past and continues to move on. And I think yesterday I read something about Microsoft building a new data center somewhere in the US, and they reopening a power plant in the neighborhood, which was already retired. I just read it somewhere. I think this goes under a slightly bigger umbrella, the overall cost of artificial intelligence.
Yep.
And that is something that organizations might not see in the madness to innovate or for innovate. And everyone is like, yes, we can use artificial intelligence to improve the efficiency of our individuals. And yes, organizations rarely don't talk about it, but one of the ideas is to make some certain people redundant, right? No one talks about it until the next layoff happens, whatever. So the idea is cost reduction. Fine. And that is perfectly valid. But they don't see the long-term cost of artificial intelligence. Now, the energy consumption, the governance, we had it a few times, that is a lot of money. And I don't know why it is so difficult to put everything together in a calculation and see what are the real costs, not just for the environment, but for the business too.
Do you think that as we start to realize the real costs, as businesses start to realize the real costs of AI, that we're going to start to see a clawback similar to the move to the cloud when everyone was so excited and move everything to the cloud, and then they realize that it's quite expensive to have everything there and maybe it's not the best answer for everything?
I think we saw that already, right? There is a couple of companies who laid off some people, and then they discovered that maybe that wasn't the best idea and rehired many of them, or most of them. I have one particular example in mind, but I don't want to name the company. The reason for rehiring them was based on poor feedback from the customers talking to an AI. So it's not directly cost related. But I think mistakes will be made. Maybe it's a good idea to not alienate your former employees and the customer base in such a process.
On the topic of the environment, I just have a question to see what everyone thinks. Do you think it's the responsibility of the data center or of the company using the data center to find additional energy options that are, you know, maybe a better environment for the earth. Like, for example, it's a huge topic here in Ireland, right? That we have a lot of data centers. Ireland's quite small and its energy infrastructure needs growth to support these data centers. So is it the responsibility of the companies utilizing the data centers or, you know, involved in the data centers to help with those initiatives in a way that is best for the environment? Or is it kind of like, nope, they can just use them?
I feel like morally, yes, it should be, but practically, they offload that by just buying the energy from somewhere. So then that responsibility is offloaded to whoever they buy energy from. So morally, in a utopian world, if you are going to be destroying the environment with what you're building and it's really cool, then you should be responsible for finding a more efficient or, you know,
sustainable.
More sustainable way of doing that thing.
Yeah.
But at least in America, I don't foresee that happening anytime soon. And it is, we already see it. And we've talked about this in the past. We did an episode with Sasha on sustainability and environmentalism last year or the year before. And we talked about that, right? Like part of it is part of the perceived responsibility can they offload somewhere else, right? Like if you are outsourcing by hosting your entities in the cloud, where does that energy consumption responsibility fall on, right? Like, so it's very complicated, I think. Am I maybe in a utopian world if you know you're going to be using like the Microsoft billion new data center and reopening a power plant, right? Like if you know you're going to be using that amount of energy and it's going to be harmful to the local area and all of those things, it would be lovely if you were responsible for increasing the green output in that area to balance things out. But I don't think that the world we live in supports that.
Fair. I had a really big aha moment when I read, okay, because I'm from the Midwest originally, right? And I'm a long-term resident in Ireland. So there are a lot of pleases and thank yous in my life. We are polite, two very polite groups of people. And I used to often interact with the AI in a similar way, right? I would say, oh, thank you for that or whatever. And it would send me another response. You're welcome. Somebody alerted me to the fact that that was a huge energy waste. And I had never considered it. But actually, yeah, every time you require additional processing that's not completely relevant to your query, that's additional energy usage. So now I've become, I fear, not very kind to the AI, but in hopes of, you know, conserving.
You are efficient.
Yes, efficient.
Well, I mean, take that a step further, right? Look at kids today. Kids are using AI for everything, and they're asking all kinds of questions. People who don't understand technology or the price or the cost of the energy consumption or any of that stuff use it to answer questions all day. So even if they're not being polite, it's now the default in search engines. You get an AI response. So whether or not you're prompting the AI, it is being prompted. So like, I think that there's also just like a dearth of knowledge in the general populace. We're not talking about IT now. A dearth of knowledge in the general populace about the cost of these things. And all they see is how it saves them time.
Yeah.
And so that's all they care about. So there is, I don't know how we maintain that balance, but
I think Lauren's being wise. It's just preparing for the inevitable takeover, and you may want to go ahead and be kind to your overlords.
That's so kind of where I was going with it.
A quick thank
you, know?
You might mean everything in the future, Lauren. So yeah. I don't know. We'll see.
I just loop in the kindness with my original query now. That's all. And no additional questions. Just thank you so much in advance.
My politeness says I have to figure out a way to incorporate it efficiently. So very good. You know, we kind of already hit this topic that I wanted to get to next, but maybe we can do a little bit more on it, or maybe this will just be me attempting to wrap it up. But you kind of mentioned the post-cloud era. It's not really a post-cloud era. It kind of is, but there's a thought, and I'm curious if you have follow-ups on this, that edge computing's becoming powerful enough to run some real AI models locally. And so there's lots of questions about, could we bring it local? Does AI have to be part of that? You know, and a lot of it is being brought more local, maybe because the power is becoming greater and smaller and more capable at a local level. But anyway, it's bringing up other questions, like there's this new term I've also seen, which is write compute first, right? Is that how I'm going to start making my decisions versus is it edge, right? Is it local? Is it cloud? Am I looking for post-cloud freedom, right? And obviously, we know cloud's not going anywhere. If anything, what I've understood is like there was the, if you're not cloud, you're not doing it right. So there was the blind leap. And so now that's where that term of write compute first is coming into play, which is, you know, where does it make more sense? Companies are being a little bit more strategic about where to do it. And it's, do you think it's going to be possible with AI in 26, or that's still a good ways out from the compute power? That's kind of where I wanted to go with this, but go ahead, Sasha.
Tell me you were surfing Gartner.com without telling me you were surfing Gartner.com. Right computing. Wow. No, I mean, it's fine. It's fine. Edge computing was a hot topic maybe 8 years ago or something, a little bit before COVID, right? But the use cases we had was like administrating traffic, etc., to put something closer to the streets, right? To use AI for this is another idea that could be good. I see advantages when it comes to data sovereignty and running a model closer to the business, actually. But obviously, the power is another thing. Availability is another thing. We should talk about resilience, actually, later. So it won't be that easy. It's an interesting use case. I don't know. We could probably try it. I'm pretty sure some will try it. But does the infrastructure give it? Do we need 6G, 7G before we can actually use it? I'm not sure if I see this happening in 2026. Let me rephrase it. We might see it in 2026, but will it be useful in 2026? That I'm not sure about.
Well, you brought up a great segue then. Resilience, Sasha, take us away.
So we are now in December, and a couple of weeks ago, half of the internet was gone. And a week later, the other half of the internet was gone. And it turned out that one hyperscaler and then the other hyperscaler, and then 2 weeks later, the another company starting with C had a bit of an impact, right? So we, or our businesses, choose these platforms for getting a few more 99.99999 uptime, resilience, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And those organizations have fancy marketing statements. And usually it worked, but we saw now that there's instances where this does not work. So it is probably individual problems somewhere there at these companies, but there should be a rethinking in 2026. And this is more on the architectural level. How will I lay out my, as an organization, my own infrastructure? Will I trust a single provider, even if they say, hey, we have 20 different locations in your country alone? No, that's not good anymore. So organizations need to rethink how to deal with big scope incidents in 2026. Probably should have in 2025, but that's gone now.
Well, we had the spark in 25. So now we'll figure out how to put out the fire. So,
yeah, multi-cloud is already becoming more common. And because of what Sasha just pointed out, that that incident is not the first time in the last year that there's been an outage across half the internet, which is a real problem. There are a lot of organizations that cannot support that level of risk when it comes to their things. They need the resilience, and they already purposefully build into their platforms, you know, HA, disaster recovery, right? Like, there's a lot of that. And so, like, maybe they had previously moved into the cloud and they were trying to centralize in one, but I don't think centralized cloud is going to be a thing anymore. Like, that, it's not supportable. I'm with Sasha on this one.
I agree completely. And I think as the dependency on technology increases, this is, you know, a critical, critical topic to understand. A personal experience, last summer, I was flying back from visiting my family in the U.S. on the day that there was, I believe it was a Microsoft outage, but it took down a lot of the airline software. Luckily, the airlines had, you know, a bunch of, I guess, processes in place, and we still flew. But, you know, there was no online check-in. There was no update. There was no baggage check-in. My flight was on time, but I think it was probably in the very, very small percentage of those that were. And that's, you know, that had a massive impact. How much money was lost, but also, you know, the safety protocol, all these things are really dependent on technology. And I think if you think about those real world examples of resiliency, as we become more and more dependent for things like this, okay, travel is generally a privilege, but there are safety protocols involved and there are things that are really dependent on the health and well-being of people. So we have to consider outages as, you know, a matter of urgency, thinking of those things in regard. So that's, I completely agree, but that's my two cents to kind of dramatize everything.
You sparked another question for me, Lauren. Do you think that this will prompt an education campaign? So the reason why I'm asking this is because we are all of a similar or close to similar enough age that we grew up before the internet and with the internet, but there are about to be or already are professionals and adults that have grown up in a time where they always had the internet and the apps and they don't know what to do. So in the situation like you described, what, like, they may not have the tools that they need. Like, we can figure it out, call people, whatever. Like, but there is a generation coming, and future generations, right, are coming up in the world and maybe have no clue what to do when the technology isn't working. So do you think that these internet outages are going to prompt more of an education campaign? Because people do have backup systems, but you might not know what they are if you're just a user of those things.
I'm thinking of, like, technology bug out bags. Like, you know, I have this bag in the corner of the room I never use, but it's there in case the apocalypse happens and I need to take my family into the woods to survive, right? We need one of those as an organization, right? It's kind of what we're getting at, is if the internet goes down, what do we do? What are our processes? And I think my opinion on it is I don't think that it will happen until we see more outages like the one that happened, the two that happened earlier this fall/winter, right? Until we start to really experience, this is just too much, I suppose, blind faith in the persistence of the convenience and availability of this kind of technology, that there's not a market for it. So if there's not a market for it, there's going to be your small cult of folks that have their little community. They might have, you know, some of their own guidebooks, processes, websites, and maybe there will be a Kickstarter and one org will make some okay money for a little bit. It'll trend. But until technology starts failing on a trend, I personally don't see it becoming something that shows up, you know, in the near future at all.
Or is it that until those of us who have lived analog and digital lives leave the workforce, is it a requirement? Yeah. Are we always there to know the processes, to know the backups? Because I actually don't know how to answer this because I have the brain that has lived both, right? So I feel quite confident that I could solve things without digital, but I don't have that fear of the unknown. So yep. It's an interesting question. You know, on my flight day, when I went to drop my bag off, they gave me a handwritten tag. I asked, am I ever going to see this again? He said, I'm not sure. And we went on our way. But there was obviously a process, and I did receive my bag. So there was obviously a process. But yeah, I'm kind of with Sean in a different way. Maybe until the workforce is a majority digital only people, they might not feel the need to create this sort of education or campaigns until it's hopefully not, you know, an emergency.
Okay, but is that not then our responsibility to leave them with the tools? Because this is actually a very similar question to the we're losing fundamental skills because of AI question, right? It's very similar on the lines of like, are we just going to leave them with no tools to support that because they don't know how to deal with those situations? So, I mean, are we going to go through the process of building and learning those things again? Is the whole, like, everybody in every industry going to have to go through that again in 20 or 30 years or whatever when we're all retired and not working anymore? Like,
so, Crystal, did you teach your son how to use a pen and a paper?
Yes.
Okay. So he's equipped for the worst failover scenarios.
In theory. In theory. But their first port of call, right, is using the internet to solve all their problems. So like the way that we teach even like is internet first. And like there is, obviously this is like, I guess it's partially a question about parenting, but I'm talking about people that are already in the workforce really. Because like, As a parent, I am responsible for teaching him how to live in the world if technology fails, sure. But if we are taking it for granted, like you have all said, right? We have reached a state of this is the world that we live in now. It's always going to be there. We feel assured that the internet is always going to be there. So will you even think about doing it? Like that's... Sean asks it, will you even think about doing it? That's a question.
Yeah, it's a great question. And as far as how individuals operate, absolutely. I think we'll all kind of keep our own idea of what should go in that bug out bag that's in the corner, right? But as far as how industries go and bringing it back to 2026 predictions, I don't see it being something of anyone's concern. Someone else on the call, I think it was you, Lauren, who mentioned or phrased it this way. There's just so much excitement about innovation right now that nothing else is on anyone's mind, right? There's just, what else can we do? Not what will happen if these other things don't work anymore. So do I see more outages like what happened this fall/winter in 26? Absolutely. And now that we've become so much more dependent, I think it's going to, and this is another topic, even though I don't know that we'll have a chance to get to it. This is going to increase bad threat actors to feel incentive to see what happens if they take away our toys, right? See what happens. See how the world flails without these things. And, you know, that's something that AI is going to play into as well is how those threat actors take action. Again, I'm not sure that we'll have time for this, but it's a fun, philosophical, scary topic, but it's definitely something that I think we shouldn't stop asking is like, when do we say, okay, I can only be so dependent on technology without realizing I need another plan? Lauren, go ahead.
I do think it brings up a really crucial, like the essence of what we're talking about is the massive change of decision making, right? Our shift is in how we make decisions. So now I don't feel the need to critically think about a decision I need to make. I can just go ask AI. And I think that covers what we talked about earlier in, you know, the job scope. So let's take a service desk agent, for example. Once I have the AI, is my prior knowledge null and void? Because now my decision making is, you know, based on the AI. Or do we view it as it's leveling the playing field that people can participate in higher levels of a job? But I do think, you know, in this example of, you know, having a fail-safe plan, we need to understand that, like, our decision-making has changed. And are we still going to continue to equip people with the ability to make a decision or research things or find their own you know, solution? I think that's the essence of what we're talking about is, are we going to completely go all in on letting the AI make our decisions? Or are we still going to equip people with the ability to problem solve and critically think, you know, based on what they have available for the problem at hand?
I guess to tie this one up, I like the way you put that because it made me think of it a little bit differently. Even if I'm supervising and approving all these things, I still have the majority of all the knowledge that I would have if I was manually doing them. Instead, it's just a let's call it, how in shape are my muscles to perform a specific activity? Can I do all these things? Sure. But I'm pretty out of shape when it comes to quickly responding to somebody. I would have to go back to a different approach to do the research or respond. So I think it's more of like a muscle memory or being in shape for what the necessary activity is. But since humans are so adaptable, we're the ones who got the processes this far anyway, I think we would be able to adjust as necessary.
I agree.
I think as well, you get better responses out of all of the AI stuff if you have that fundamental knowledge, if you know the right questions to ask, if you know the right prompts to give it. You don't have the fundamental knowledge of whatever you're trying to get it to do, you won't necessarily be able to get to the end result that you want. So I agree. I think it's still, you still have to work those muscles, maybe just not as hard as you used to.
Fair.
I'm getting old. I'm just kidding. So I think we've done a pretty great job of exhaustively talking about AI especially, but some good topics and trends for 2026. Guests, do you have any other topics that you want to approach as we prepare to end our episode today?
Well, you know, I like to talk about games like the majority of us does. But I read something the other day, so we should probably postpone this discussion because GTA is not making it next year, right?
It's been delayed again.
Well, we'll definitely have to do an AI-dedicated topic when it comes to games and maybe entertainment altogether.
Oh, that's a contentious topic, my friend.
Well, then it'll be some good content.
I'm curious. I want to know everybody's at-home, favorite at-home automation. What things are people automating in their own lives?
Google Photos.
My mailbox. I live in an apartment building and I don't see when anyone drops a letter into my mailbox. So I put like an environmental sensor in my mailbox and using Z-Wave as a protocol. And my watch is going like bzz, 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 whenever I receive a mail. Unfortunately, this will only get me a little bit more closer to the bills I receive all the time. But the idea was there. It works. It works.
Oh, that's great.
That is a good idea.
That's great. I had said Google Photos. And it's actually so automated, I wouldn't even do it if it didn't already do it for me as a process. But I love it because I'm really good at being in the moment to the point where I don't capture any moments. So it's such a blessing to me because I grew up with photo albums and I'm not on social media. So when I take pictures, I almost never touch them or look at them again. So I've got all these pictures on my phone that I'll never use, never look at. I don't post really to put them somewhere to go back and be like, oh, I got a like, let me go. Oh yeah, I remember that picture. So what Google does is they obviously bring up memories. If you use Google, right, you'll see it says, oh, this is you last year, or you 7 years ago. But it also has a book option. So I've created a tradition to where I will do a book based on the year at Christmas every year. So every Christmas we get a The Sebrings, and it's just kind of me and my family, what happened in that year. And so now I have my hard copy, talking about getting off the internet. I have my hard copy of memories that I wouldn't have. And Google does so much of the work for me, including just reminding me, like if I started the book and didn't finish the book, it's like, hey, you were working on this. You want to finish buying it? Right. And I love that because I would just forget to make the time to do something like that without it.
That's really nice.
That's really nice. Yeah. Mine is boring. It's lights. I just got new RGB exterior lighting installed, so in time for Christmas, and all of my lights are automated. That's so many RGB lights in my house right now.
The Internet of Things. Lauren, you brought it up, so what's yours?
Okay, I have an existing automation and a 2026 automation. My existing automation, I have ADHD, so in your iPhone, in your reminders, you can set for it to remind you of something when you leave a location, which was like a huge crux for me growing up, is that I would always leave the house without the thing. So Now I can, you know, tell Siri to set a reminder and set it to remind me when I leave, like it knows my physical location, or when it connects to the Bluetooth in my car. This has like changed my life. So as long as I remember in the moment of the thing I need to take with me and I set that reminder, I can't tell you, like things are so much better for me. But my 2026 automation is, I think I want an automated cat litter box. I want that bad boy to just detect and clean.
You know,
my cousin has one. She loves it.
Yeah.
It gives you some pretty interesting metrics that you wouldn't think are necessary, and you start paying attention to.
Really?
Like how much KPIs. Your cat weighs before and after and that kind of thing. So it's, some unique metrics, but very handy when it comes to keeping it clean.
That's really helpful. That's what I'm looking for. So that's my 2026 automation goal at home.
You know, that's my last minute 2026 trend edition, is that we're going to have even more unnecessary metrics added to literally everything.
Literally everything?
Yeah.
Literally.
Dad joke.
So when we sit here next year, Lauren, you can tell us about the poop summary of your kitty, right?
I can't wait. Yeah, I think I might pair it with, you know, the litter that is like color-coded to tell you when certain things. I think I might, you know, cross-reference all of my metrics.
You're going to have so much data.
I'm going to come to 2027 IT trends with a spreadsheet. Don't worry, guys.
Well, it's not so bad being trendy. That's a line from a song. Go look it up if you want. Great ska band, older. Anyway, I want to say thank you to our guests. Again, it's fun when we get extra guests, you know, a bigger conversation. So, Sasha, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy New Year.
Lauren, thanks for joining us, and hopefully we'll get to have you back on again soon.
Would love that. Thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
It's been an exciting episode. I'm your host, Sean Sebring, joined by, of course, fellow host, Crystal Taylor. If you haven't yet, make sure to subscribe and follow for more TechPod content. Thanks for tuning in.
Wahaha!